You talked about modernity and the metaphor. The metaphor of the house of modernity has become useful, I think, as a shortcut to talk about all the aspects of modernity and not get distracted by one or the other. And we invite people to imagine a planet as a sphere in a house that is exceeding the limits of the planet. It's becoming bigger than the planet. And the house has a few features that are characteristic of the house. And the first feature is that there is a foundation of separation, what we call separability. And this separation is the separation between humans and nature, or the so-called nature. We are also nature, but there is a supposed separation there. And this separation is what creates rankings, because it removes the intrinsic value of life, and then it imposes hierarchies of value between species, between cultures, between individuals, and it also sees the land as property and property owners as people with higher value in the hierarchies. So that's the foundation of the house. Then there are two walls, carrying walls, structural walls. One wall is the wall of the modern nation state, and we tend to think about the modern nation state as something that is there to protect people. However, the history of the modern nation state is about the protection of property, of capital, and property owners. So, what happens then is that when there is interest convergence between the protection of people and the protection of capital, the state will protect both. But when it has to choose between protecting people or protecting capital, it protects capital. So when we have human rights, labor rights, civil rights, it's because there was interest convergence. In order to protect capital, it was useful to protect people as well. But when there is no interest convergence, they cancel the rights and protect the capital. So that's one carrying law.
It reminds me just briefly of the neutron bomb, that would destroy all organic life, but keep the property in the buildings and so forth intact. This was an advance. It's sort of perfect for your carrying wall.
Absolutely. The property remains intact. It destroys life. The other carrying wall on the other side is the carrying wall of Enlightenment humanism, where you have a single story of progress, development, and civilization that tries to erase the other stories. And we call this epistemicide. It tries to kill other possibilities and impose itself as a universal story of progress, development, and civilization, of engineering a perfect society. And in that sense, indigenous worldviews and possibilities of a different relationship with the world, with time, with self, they are erased, and often violently erased. And this erasure also happens through education, the imposition of Western education. So the story constrains the ways we can live and erases other possibilities of being well, of living well, of dying well, in the metabolism of the planet. And it also imposes that we are separated and that our purpose is to create value within the economies of modernity, within the economies of the house. And the last thing about the house the basic thing is the roof. So there were different kinds of roof that have been tried before. For example, industrial capitalism was one kind of roof, but right now we have the roof of speculative algorithmic capitalism that is different from other roofs of the house. And this roof is structurally damaged because for several reasons, but one of them being this push for goal optimization, the optimization of activities in the house is for profit creation. So in that kind of economy, every actor has a fiduciary duty to increase profit for shareholders who are anonymous. So we are all part of this. Almost impossible to not be part of it. If you have a credit card, you're part of it. And there is no possibility of government control or for assigning responsibility. It's just how the system operates based on profit maximization. So in the book, we talk about other aspects of the house, about how the house was created and is sustained through structural and systemic violence. And then how inside the house there's overconsumption and overproduction of waste. And we're not even happy. That's also the other part of it. It creates an insatiable desire for consumption that doesn't really lead to well-being, while we then trash the planet. So the waste production goes back to the planet, and there's extraction, constant exponential extraction of resources from the planet into the house. So in the book, we talk about the house cracking, fracturing, and collapsing under the weight of climate destabilization, biodiversity apocalypse, biodiversity collapse, hyperpolarization. And inside the house, we see mental health crisis, housing crisis, political crisis, economic crisis. And then when we ask how do we face this crisis together, then there are different approaches to it. But generally, we have people who want to fix the house a little bit or expand the house. We have people who want to reform the house and bring different leadership in. And we have people who say, we can't, the house is unsustainable. We have to find another way. We have to compost the house, basically. And it's through this composting that something new will emerge from the cracks and from the composting itself. So when we go, I'm invited to be in lots of meetings today of people trying to tackle these global challenges, and you can see these different approaches to the house. So the first one is about faith, like placing your hope in the continuity of the system and hoping for a miracle, because exponential growth-based economies in a finite planet, the equation doesn't add up. So people in this who have hope in the continuity, they are thinking about a technological solution, or sometimes eugenics, sometimes they are thinking about life in another planet. But the idea is that the lifestyle of consumption and production continues. Then we have another group who believes that we need an alternative right now, and we need an alternative that compels substantial consensus, so that we can replace that system for something already known. And then you have a lot of competing ideas about what could replace the old or what's not working. And then we have a third line of people who say, we have already crossed the tipping points. Consensus is not going to be possible right now. And what we need to do is prepare ourselves to face the consequences of the choices we have made. And it is through that composting and growing up through the composting that we will learn from the old system deeply and open up the space for the earth itself to dream something through us once we open ourselves to sensing that we are part of a much larger metabolism. We are not above nature, we are part of it, and nature itself speaks and teaches where to go. So this epigenetic shift, it, as I said before, it's not just a shift in thinking. And when we went to the Amazon in the last 2 weeks, when we were there, we were trying to learn from the communities the ways in which they open themselves up to being taught by the forest. So they don't feel that they are the sovereign agents that will bring about change, but they ask the forest what the forest wants us to do. And part of the paintings were the purpose of the painting in introducing us to the forest was to ask the forest to speak to us as well as people from coming from other places, mostly from the global north, and to bring the message of the forest and translate it in a way that becomes intelligible for other people. So it's interesting because this kind of communication is post-verbal. It's not, the communication of the forest is not through words, it's through sensing. And the sensing requires, it's inevitable that it requires that we sit with the violence that is creating the deforestation, that is creating the climate change that is happening in the Amazon, that is creating the droughts, that is creating the floods. And not to see the droughts and the floods just as outside of us, but inside. So, because our bodies are land, we need to figure out a way or sense into a way where we can see climate change and biodiversity collapse happening inside and have a structure, a psychological structure that can hold that. And they are really concerned that those people who are just used to the house of modernity, who were born there, their psychological structure, our psychological structure, cannot hold what's coming. And when we are living in the house, we are also the people creating collapse for others, like in the Amazon, right? So in a way, the people in the Amazon are used to collapse, and they can swim in these waters better than we can. And one of the concerns we heard is that when we think about collapse, we generally think about here in the global north about lack of access to energy or water or to money even. But when they think about collapse, it's the psychological structure. So we, in their words, it would be not their words, but their sense, it would be they are more worried about the psychological collapse that is going to happen when people will turn against each other to protect the comforts that they have because they are unable to face the storms and to move with the storms because they have not been trained or prepared for that. So one of the requests we got was to work towards preparing a different psychological structure with a different genetic expression that can, instead of turning people against each other, bring people together, but not just towards themselves, but towards the land itself, and to open up the possibility for this sensing that comes from the earth itself, so that what the next steps are guided by something that is more than human through the messages of the forest itself.
Thank you. I mean, I think it's very clear that the modern Western individual is not capable of withstanding the kind of reckoning that we're being asked. That is what our reality is leading us to, the reality that we've created, which is, you're saying, is this house that produces more waste than it produces more goods than it can assimilate it, that it's overproducing and creating corrupting the planet. Or putting the planet in a situation of crisis and a struggle to balance itself. I mean, that's these storms and so forth. It's like our Earth trying to find its way in response to what it is that we've done. It seems that there's something that we're called to open ourselves to that requires something beyond ourselves as individuals to anchor in order to be able to face it. That if you face it as a solitary individual, and that's where your belief that this is simply who you are, and this is the beginning and end of yourself. You're walking on very, very thin ice, you could say. Because the context that we've created of this kind of destruction, and the way that we are all profoundly implicated, or just in an everyday way, we are so implicated in this. But to be able to have the what we in our corner of the universe speak about is to have the spiritual resilience to put the intelligence of life before one's own particular comfort or safety. To be able to face what needs to be faced and be rooted in the power of the life force, or not as something that we would manipulate or be in charge of, but that we are surrendered to. That we have the courage to surrender to something that is bigger than ourselves, that is alive, that is life. And I think that most, that many, many of us, let's put it that way, are numb. And there's a numbness in relationship to the reality that we're in. And then we flip into despair or numbness and despair. And there's a strength in being able to really face this together. And I said this when we were talking earlier, that the separate individual cannot respond to this in a way, any way that is meaningful or healthy. because it's the separation itself that actually is what is at core the problem. You call it, you have an interesting term, what is it? Separativeness?
Separability.
Separability. Yeah. The belief that we can be separated from all of this. And it's can we with our feet on the earth, really together face what this is in a way that gives us strength in life or faith in life. And I don't mean a belief in life, but because this process that you're talking about kind of opening ourselves, it's like, what is that? What is that opening? And it seems that one aspect of that opening is you could, I mean, people talk about grief work, but it's not simply grief work. It's standing in what's true and our implicatedness in that what's true.
Yeah. So we've been trying to map what educationally would be necessary to interrupt certain things and reactivate others at cognitive levels, but not focusing on cognition, but at affective levels, emotionally, and at relational levels where we generally put our hands in the gut for that. And also neurophysically, right? So we in the house of modernity, we are addicted to dopamine, which reinforces, in this case, reinforces the separation. Or we are addicted to a misuse of oxytocin, right? In our relationships, when they are conditional and transactional. We want the others to meet all our expectations, or else if we discard them and we look for somebody who can, right? We are not able to relate to everything from a different space, from a different neurobiology, basically. In the relationships we have with everything, and I'm just not just with people or the world, like the world externally, but we even with ourselves is framed by the house. And it's like a spreadsheet, right, of transactions and how much I put in, how much is my worth, and if I'm not good, I'm bad. And if I give this to somebody, there's a debt. So it's a, we call it a ledger, a spreadsheet. And in the new book, we talk about whole shebang. Whole shebang is an English expression that is about everything, everywhere, everywhen, all the
All at
time,
once.
all at once. So that's whole shebang relationality, where you can see yourself both in your timeline, in the timeline of your body, but also in the timeline of humanity, in the timeline of the planet. And you can see all the implications of all these metabolic movements, catabolic and anabolic movements in a much wider frame, right? In a much, much wider. It's not just me, it's me as part of a metabolism, both within my temporality, within humanity's temporality, and beyond humanity. And you can see it in a wider view. So we call this process, one of the things that is needed is this diffraction. It's seeing ourselves in multiple layers of time, multiple layers of self. Understanding, for example, that if time is not linear, our ancestors are here with us. both the ones who have come before and the ones who are coming afterwards. And it's our communication and accountability towards them that then makes it possible for us to have other possibilities, for other choices, for different decisions. So in the book, there are some exercises that, for example, ask you to talk to your past ancestors and explain what's happening right now and ask them to liberate you from the projections that they've had set upon you. So many of them made lots of sacrifices, sometimes were involved in a lot of violence with a wrong idea to secure a future for you. And we need a liberation from those projections and expectations so that you can do today what is better for the continuity of life, the sustainability of life and the future. And one of the exercises asks you to imagine a cloud with seven generations of grandmothers. So for you to be here today, if we count seven generations back without your mother, it's around 120 grandmothers that were involved in the possibility for your existence. And one of the things we ask people to do is to think about the lives of these grandmothers and how they might have been subject to oppression, how they might have contributed to oppression. This is not to romanticize the grandmothers, but to have an idea of the intergenerational and epigenetic weight of trauma that is being carried up to your own existence. And we ask several questions, and we ask questions about difference. So how many of these grandmothers married, were forced to marry? How many of these grandmothers were gender diverse? How many of these grandmothers had miscarriages and abortions? How many of these grandmothers had lovers? How many of these grandmothers could do a cartwheel, for example, so that we have a relationship with them as complex human beings, not villains, not heroes of stories, not saviors, but as complex human beings caring a lot in their lifetimes. And then we ask people to talk to the grandmothers and acknowledge the suffering, acknowledge the joy, acknowledge their lifetime, and then explain that right now we are at crunch time, checkmate time for humanity, and we need something different. So we ask the grandmothers to also help us here in service of life to make different choices and to see the different choices that can be made. See what's already viable but unimaginable from where we stand, so they can see maybe from different dimensions, and they can also help in the process. And if they are unwilling to do so, to also forgive, right? Mm-hmm. But then say, if you're unwilling to support what we're trying to do, please step aside, right? Don't get in the way of the change and the transformation that is needed to give life a chance, given what is happening right now. So this ritualistic movement is a way of finding a new vocabulary to talk about the ancestors, to talk about time, and to talk about our responsibility to become good elders and good ancestors as well. Mm-hmm. For those who are coming after us. Mm-hmm. And in modernity, we don't have a language for that. The only responsibility that is passed through is the responsibility to leave a legacy, or to leave financial security, or to leave in a kind of a monument where you are not going to be forgotten. And that is very much part of that transactional spreadsheet and ledger. that has gotten us to the mess we're in today. And the exercises in the book try to bring in humor and joy in this process. And this comes from ancestral wisdom, especially of communities that have been at the receiving end of the violence. That, and this is coming specifically from Catherine O'Dora Hoppers, who said that if something is serious, if it's a life and death issue, you can only survive with joy.
Makes me think of the election in the United States. Well, and actually, joy is a fascinating thing, isn't it? It's not just humor. It's not just jokes or lightheartedness. It's actually like a resonance of life force, or it's despite everything, there's this. Despite everything, there's this. And this is a frequency that is radiant.
It is a vibrational field.
Yeah.
That's how we refer to it too. And it goes back to what you were talking about, surrender. It's about being present and aligned with the movement of things. There is a quote when you were speaking, I'll put it in the chat, that surrender is not passive, it's active alignment with what's unfolding. Knowing that resistance only prolongs the suffering. And in that alignment, you dance.
And that, I think, is the opening, right? This is the opening to something. It's interesting. An opening that can also, if we slow down and are keenly curious, can lead us to the recognition that we don't start really from separation, do we? And that's not an idea. That can be a felt experience of our connectedness before our separation, or our differentiation. It doesn't have to be. There's something very different between differentiating and cultivating. I mean, we each have our own ancestors, although when you start talking about 120 grandmothers, you're who knows what cultures they came from, what where they were living on the planet, how they were living. We each span multitudes, don't we?
And we're not even talking about the grandfathers yet. That
Yeah, we're not, you're only going back seven, right? And all of us who are here are products of 100, I don't know how many generations there have been since the beginning of humanity, but that I get such a sense of a web, such a web that is so intertwined with the biosphere at this at you know, because it's it you can't in that way, you can't just say I'm this or that. This is my identity. It really shakes that up.